Preparing to delve in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Delve. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Alex.
And, Alex, you feel like going on a caper?
What kind?
A great train caper. It involves a train. Oh, that's a robbery. It's the Great Train Robbery. No, I don't know. You know any good capers?
I feel like you're going to tell me about one.
I am going to tell you one, and it's not something that I put on fish. Today on the show, we are very happy to have Craig Campbell on the program talking about his RPG Capers, which is set in the Roaring Twenties. And Craig, thank you for coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show. Yes, it is capers time. Not the food stuff, not the thing that goes on fish.
No. It's very important that we make mention of that because some people are going to get really jazzed up thinking that they're going to like a restaurant. But no, it's not that kind of a thing. No. What we're talking about is an RPG that's set in the 20s that has, you know, gangsters and superpowers, if I'm getting this right.
Yeah, it's a super-powered RPG of gangsters in the Roaring Twenties. So you're essentially playing gangster types who are out to make their fortune in the 1920s during Prohibition, when alcohol is illegal in the United States. Mm-hmm. And look, you know, it's playing off of the you know, the romanticized version of that you might see in television series and movies and so forth, with all the, you know, shootouts and the big casinos and speakeasies and back alley deals and all that sort of thing, except that you have kind of sort of low to mid range superpowers, not nothing world bendy, nothing, you know, you're not going to mind control everybody in the city, but you've got some cool things that you can do. But so do your rivals. And so do the cops and the feds. And alternatively, you can play law enforcement as well if you so choose. There's, you know, all the information is available for that. And you can, you know, attempt to bring those criminals to justice.
Ah, I see. So I'm not quite Avengers level superpowers.
No.
More defenders.
I guess you could put it that way. If any Avenger, you know, maybe Hawkeye, you know, maybe you can be super agile and really good with a bow, but you're not indestructible or, you know, hopping. Hopping across the city in a single bound or anything like that.
Yeah. Okay. So, I guess maybe more defenders like the Daredevils or Jessica Jones of the Marvel universe.
Sure.
That more street level kind of thing. That's really interesting. Why did you want to create this kind of a role playing game?
Well, what happened was I had a game that I made before this, which is called Murders and Acquisitions, and that's sort of set in a modern day. But then I built these rules, you know, kind of plug and play rules where, you know, if you want to put fantastical stuff in there, like monsters and magic or cosmic horror or future tech or something, you can do all of those things. So you can kind of mix and match the game system. And one of the things that never made it in there was superpowers, because that seemed a little wrong for the particular game I was designing. And I set it aside. And when I got around to designing a second game, I was like, well, I dig Super's stories. I'm not a huge comic book reader. I've read some, and so I'm not looking to make like a game that is like a superheroes game and like a modern day superhero supervillains with, you know, capes and cowls and all that kind of stuff. Because to be quite frank, there are plenty of those out there, and there are some great games, and they do it really well. And so I started tooling around, like, well, maybe if I took like the idea of superpowered people, but they're not necessarily heroic. They're just people who have superpowers. What does that mean? And then I started looking at periods in history that interest me in particular, because I figured if I'm going to build something historical, and that would be kind of a neat thing because the last game was modern day, I want to pick something that I'm, you know, is an era of history that I like, that I would enjoy researching. And so I bounced around a few different ideas, and ultimately, like a binge watch of Boardwalk Empire from HBO kind of settled it. As I was watching that, I thought, like, you know, well, what if this guy had a superpower? What if that person had a superpower? And then I started thinking about, like, well, you know, what would superpowers, how would that color that world? And started to just kind of slowly build that idea. And, in time, it kind of all coalesced into the general idea of what the world was about and with gangsters. And so that's kind of a fun thing, too. But you got these cool powers. You know, once I had kind of the idea for the world and what the game is about and what the characters are doing, then I expanded out from there and started looking at rule systems and fleshing out the world and starting to think about, really what would it be like if somebody that was super strong was running around, 1920s Chicago.
What is the rule system like?
The rule system uses decks of playing cards, actually. Every player and the GM has their own deck of playing cards that they use, 52 suit cards plus both jokers. And the way it basically works is, without getting too far into the guts of the system, basically you'll have a certain number of cards that you can flip for a particular check. And in the game, that's referred to as your card count. And it might range from 1 up to 3. With certain superpowers, it might be a 4 or a 5. Okay. And so you've got a certain number of cards that you can flip off the top of your deck, revealing them one at a time. And each time you flip it, you have to decide whether you're going to stick with that card or flip another one. And the basic mechanic is that the pip value of the card from 2, 3, 4 all the way up to ace high, that determines success or failure. So you might need, a 9 or better in order to succeed. You might need a queen or better to succeed. The suit of the card determines the degree of success or failure for that flip. And clubs are the worst, going alphabetically up to spades. Spades is always the best suit that you can flip. And so, for example, you might flip a king of clubs. A king is almost certainly successful, but it's a club, so it's going to be barely successful, and there's probably going to be some sort of a complication tied to that success. And so you could stick with that card, or assuming you have more card count available to you, you could flip another card. And now that king of clubs is off the table, the new card is what you're looking at. And you might fail, or you might succeed with a better success. So every card flip, every trait check is kind of like a little mini gambling game.
Originally, when you were making the game, was the intent always to use like a regular deck of cards?
I've never designed anything with playing cards before. I've played games that utilize cards, like the old original Deadlands used playing cards fairly extensively, but it still used dice. And there are some other games out there that use cards to some extent. There's a handful of really indie games that are, that use like actual, decks of cards. Full deck, that's all you use, is like a deck of cards. So I kind of looked at originally I was looking at just dice because that's what I was used to, and I even considered adapting the dice system that I had developed for Murders and Acquisitions and just like, I'll take that and I'll fine-tune it. But ultimately I kind of like started looking at the playing card thing as like partly is kind of like a challenge to myself, like what can I do with playing cards, what would be interesting and challenging for me. But I looked at a handful of other playing card systems, how they're integrated into the mechanics, whether they're just cards or cards with dice or whatever. Quite a lot of them have you drawing like a hand of cards. So you actually have a hand of a certain number of cards, and you'll be making choices about which card you're going to play when. And so you're kind of looking at a hand, and there's a failure in there. I'm going to have to decide when I'm going to, at some point I'm going to have to fail. How do I want to deal with that?
Right.
But I thought about, the neat thing about cards is that, like when you roll a die, you look at the number. That's basically it. Now, technically, you could also look at, is it odd or even? Sometimes, the highest die result or the lowest die result means something special. But usually it's just, you look at the number. But with a deck of cards, you flip a card, you've got the pip value. You've got the suit of the card, you've got the color of the card, you've got whether or not it's a face card or not, you've got whether or not it's odd or even, you've got whether or not it's a joker or not. Are aces special? There's a lot of things you can do with that. So I started tinkering around with the idea, and I kind of fell into this press your luck mechanic that's really kind of just, one card at a time. The card is basically doing what dice do.
Right.
But because the card stays on the table, there's a history.
Right.
Whereas you normally roll the die and then you pick it up, and now you're back to one. And, if it's a D20, it's a 1 in 20 chance.
Yeah.
With the card, you're flipping and there's a history, and so that one card sits there and you decide whether you're going to keep that. If you don't, you're going to flip another card. And now both of those cards are out of your deck. And so the longer you play, you kind of get a sense of what's not in your deck anymore. So there becomes like another level to this press your luck sort of gambling system where you're kind of counting cards. Like, I know there's a lot of face cards left, so now I should start taking risks because I've got the big cards coming.
Oh, yeah.
It turned out to be a very engaging system at the table. People really enjoy looking at like not even just their own card flipping. They're looking at other people and kind of they know, like, you know, Bob over here, he's blown through a lot of his face cards. And so I'm telling him, it's like, be careful, man. Don't push it right, too hard because yeah. You've got a lot of twos, threes and fours in there. And that mm-hmm. bad joker is still in there, too, because the two jokers, one of the jokers is good, does really good things. One of the jokers is bad. And so, you know, have you seen that bad joker or not yet? Because every time, if you haven't seen it, every card flip is putting you closer to it.
Sure.
And then yeah. something really bad is going to happen to your character. So I wanted to try it out as a challenge. It looked like it, you know, I tested it out with some friends. It seemed engaging. It had some legs. And I just, you know, over the course of a year and a half or so, just built it all on out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, dice and cards definitely have a different kind of risk system involved, because with dice, you know, you could just be throwing sixes all the time or ones, but with, you know, a deck of cards, it is always going to be a certain number of each thing. It's just when you're going to pull them. So I imagine that changes a lot of the mechanics around.
Yeah, and then you get to the point of like hoping, okay, is the GM are we going to go through enough cards and enough encounters where the GM is not going to call for a reshuffle so I can get those good cards back in my deck.
I think it's actually really thematic to the game, too, because you know what else uses cards? Poker.
Poker, blackjack, yeah.
Blackjack, and you know where they are? Casinos.
Where they're serving drinks in the 20s, yeah, baby.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know,
They're in bathhouses with that bootleg liquor.
that's an interesting scenario. Please continue your thought, Alex.
Nope, that was my whole thought. Bootleg. I mean, it's prohibition, okay. So it's all bootleg.
This is true. This is true. I'll give you that.
Playing cards while you stir in the bathtub.
You're really hung up on the bathtub thing.
Bathtub gin is the thing, right? It's, you know, the
yeah.
people would.
It was
would,
a thing, Nathan.
Yeah, it was a thing. Where you could, where people, when Prohibition hit, people found ways to get their own alcohol, and it happened in a number of ways. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways was to make your own, and usually you didn't have the right equipment or very good equipment, so you had, you know, some people who kind of knew their way around it might have homemade stills. Or might be able to ferment, you know, and create beer and wines and meads and, you know, things like that, fruit stuff and uh-huh. beer. But then other people, you know, like you could make, you know, higher proof alcohol just with, I mean, really all you need is like the right ingredients, the right conditions, mm-hmm. And the containers to keep them in.
Right.
So yeah, that's the bathtub gin. That's that was a thing. It wasn't the best gin.
No, I imagine.
But it got you drunk.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I guess as long as you can get fermentation going for you, you're basically fine. Alcohol's alcohol, I suppose, unless you
can. Can my superpower be fermenting fruit?
No, that's not a superpower in the game, I'm afraid.
Or
so you can't just be a super powerful brewer.
Or if you had like the power of time. You could just
right.
age fruit automatically.
Cause the fermentation to quicken.
Yes, you could even speed up the growth of trees so that you could get apples faster.
you can be super smart and therefore be able to come up with better ways to create illegal alcohol and produce it faster. That's certainly something that you can do.
So I can make a still. I would know how to do
make this. Like the best still, you know.
Oh, I like this. Okay, cool. So that's I think what I'm going to do. Alex, I think you're more like the popo. You're the law enforcement guy.
oh good.
So
I just have the superpower to destroy all your things.
to wreck all my hopes and dreams.
Well, sure. Yep. We'll go the classic Superman Brainiac route of like, you know, the super smart villain offset by the super strong hero. So the, you know, if you gotta, you know, as the illegal bootlegger that's super smart and, you know, you've got all your tendrils out there and you've got alcohol being made all over the place and it's really working fast and mm-hmm. you're, you know, keeping it hidden and all that good stuff because you're super smart. But you don't want, if you slip up once, that super strong federal agent, that Prohibition Bureau agent is going to come rolling in there and he is going to smash the ever-loving crap out of all your hard work.
Oh, no. And I've been working on my upper body strength to carry kegs. Damn. I think, I don't know if Capers was ever meant to be like an adversarial game, but I feel like if Alex and I played, that's exactly what would happen. We'd have to be on opposing sides and play different characters trying to wreck each other's day.
Well, I mean, it's not built inherently to be a PvP kind of game, but there is nothing that says you can't switch sides to another, you know, rival bootlegging gang or, you know, gangster organization, criminal organization. There's nothing to say that you couldn't play a game where one of the players is secretly playing an undercover agent.
I was just thinking that totally.
And then,
undercover.
And then, you know, about, you know, like three or four sessions in, then they get a chance to reveal that. And you don't necessarily get to play that continuously, but you know, you could have a few sessions of fun where the undercover agent is kind of surreptitiously sabotaging what you're doing, trying to make sure you don't quite succeed at things until some opportunity arises where they can really, you know, where that character can make a bust and really get one or two of the other characters. I mean, you could do that. I got no problem with that.
Nice.
That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I'm gonna bust your gin bathtub wide open.
I'm gonna crack that bathtub right open. I'm just gonna put like foot soak Epsom salt in your bathtub. Delicious, right?
Salty gin.
Oh my god. Salty gin.
Sounds terrifying.
Oh boy, that's a martini no one wanted. It's like you take the salt rim and you put it right in the glass. That's horrible. We never want that. Yeah, I think we ruined alcohol for people on the show.
Good.
Yeah, it's probably for the best. It's okay, folks.
But that's okay. You don't have to make your own. You can also illegally import it from Canada or Mexico or the Caribbean or Europe. There's
ooh,
lots.
I can be a
Yeah, you can have a smuggling game. Absolutely.
Yay! Oh well, boy, that adds a whole new level of challenge right there. This is good. Yeah, I mean, I like the setting. I think it's interesting because, you know, the 1920s is actually a really interesting time in American history, and there aren't a lot of games that, you know, talk about that particular period.
Yeah, usually if it's a 1920s game, it's most commonly it's a Cthulhu game.
Mm.
And you know, that kind of a dark pulp game.
The dark horror sort of thing.
Yeah. And occasionally, you know, if it's like 20s, 30s, it'll be like a noir kind of thing, like, you know, dark, seedy underbelly of the city kind of deal.
Sure.
But there are not a lot of gangster RPGs out there.
No.
There are a few generic settings that like GURPS had, like a gangland or gangsters or something like that supplement. Of course, GURPS had a supplement for everything. And there might be a few others that are kind of, you know, like a supplement that helps. You know, you can tell the gangster stories in a with a universal system, but
yeah,
that there's not a lot in the way of like straight up gangster games that are geared toward being gangster games.
Right. Yeah. I want to say I think I remember Fate having something that was a supplement that was sort of in that vein, but I don't think it was just straight up like that. I think it might have been set in the 20s, but there was an overlay on it like. Oh, like it was a zombie fiction or something like that. So there was that. But you went the other route and you said it's like Heroes, but with in the 20s.
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, you can play the heroic type if you're a federal agent or a cop or whatever. But it's a little, it's a little on the anti-hero side because you are kind of playing the bad guy. The romanticized version of the bad guy. But that's not to say that you can't have redeeming qualities. You know, the game is built with every character has a virtue and a vice.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you're playing a gangster, you're going to have a virtue that you're going to choose. And there's something that your character does that's good and right, and they will never abandon that ideal. And mm-hmm. even if you're playing a good, upstanding law enforcement officer, you're going to have a vice. You're going to have something that gets in the way of you doing your job. And, you know, for example, your vice could be you're an alcoholic,
right.
You know, or any of a number of other things. So it's not quite, you know, black hats and white hats. There's a little bit of shades of gray in the game.
Right. Yeah. And I just thought to myself, what I think I want to model my character after is Deadpool. Because as far as anti-heroes go, that's pretty much my go-to I'm trying to think. Could I have like regeneration capabilities?
There are powers in the game that allow you to heal more quickly. You can have a superior resilience, and the ability to heal, to gain your hits back a little bit faster. You can do that. You can give the character, a pretty solid set of just fighting skills in general. If you want to play like, the bruiser, enforcer, tough kind of character, you can certainly do that. It's very much a skill based system. It's not a class kind of thing. So you can play pretty much any, archetype that you can think of, or you can go kind of a little more jack of all trades and kind of mix and match a number of things together. Some disparate skills along with some disparate powers. You can kind of, it's possible to create kind of a Swiss Army knife character where you've got a tool for darn near anything. You may not be the most powerful sure. and the most successful at what all the things you can do, but you sure can do a lot of stuff. There's rules in the game for instead of being super powered in terms of like you having like this manifested ability in yourself, you can have super cool abilities that are tied to gear, or you can also play completely unpowered characters who are just really highly skilled.
Oh, okay.
So you can play the Punisher type or the Batman type or the Iron Man type that they don't have, they didn't get bit by anything radioactive and they're not from another planet. They're right. just really good at certain things, or they have cool stuff.
They have cool gadgets that they can use to defeat a big alien monster.
But it needs to be the 1920s version of that cool gadget. So it's going to be big and bulky and
steampunky almost. It's
a little bit. I avoided the term steampunky. But it is like that. I think of it a little bit more as, I tried to kind of think of it in terms of like mad science. Think of it kind of like, these contraptions are going to be, steampunk tends to have an aesthetic that's very specific, where in here the gear, you can kind of define what your aesthetic is that you want it to be, or every piece of gear can be like really, really different because it was made by a different person who knows, some mad scientist type who knows how to manipulate a special element that's available. That's kind of, if you want to put the science behind your powers, you can just play the game where, everybody's got superpowers and woo. Or you can put the science behind it, and there's a newly discovered element that people have found, and that's what they're manipulating in order to make the cool gear.
I really like the idea, and the aesthetic is really cool. I was also really surprised. You got featured on Geek and Sundry.
Yeah,
that's a thing.
That is the thing that happened, isn't it? Wow. Yeah, it was. I kind of, sort of, a little bit, kind of know a person who works, who occasionally writes for Geek and Sundry, and I spent a couple of days at the beginning of the campaign when everything kicked off, and I kind of had this, imposter syndrome thing that came down on me. I was like, well, I could try to talk to the Geek and Sundry folks, but Geek and Sundry doesn't give two toots about my game. You're like, yeah, it's a waste of time. Right. And eventually, after a couple of days, I was like, well, screw it. My game's as good as any other game out there. I'll give it a shot. And I talked to somebody, and they talked to somebody, and then there was a talk there, and those people had a talk, and the person came back to me and talked to me, and there were some questions asked. And it took like, a couple of weeks, where I just sat quietly without, kind of like, it's probably going to happen. This is coming. And there was a point where I was told, okay, now it's definitely happening. The article had been turned in. But at the same time, the person, my contact, didn't know when it was on the schedule for. And there was a possibility, I was told, that it would go up after the Kickstarter. There's like, they didn't have any say in the scheduling. So I was like, this might just become like a post Kickstarter little bump that I can send people toward backer kit with. And then I found out that it was going to be on their site before, during the Kickstarter, before the Kickstarter ended, like 2 days before it was, scheduled. So I breathed a sigh of relief, and then I just kind of sat and waited quietly, because I kept it as a surprise. And it was pretty, it worked out pretty good for me that we had a huge spike in backers over the next few days after that article came out. So quite a few people found it through Geek and Sundry. So I'm very thankful to the fine folks over there, and to my contact for helping get it noticed.
It's a really big boom when you have somebody like that come in and give you a little shout out. Not just a shout out, but a whole article nonetheless. It's hard, like, trying to approach bigger outlets and thinking that, like, you're not going to get anywhere with them, because why would I? But then a lot of times they're really impressed with the things that you bring out. So I guess we just have to be courageous.
Nathan's been dealing with this lately.
I've been dealing with this lately when I was like, yeah, sure, why don't I just try to get people on the show who probably won't come on the show? And then they're like, yeah, sure, I'll come talk to you on the show. And I'm like, oh, that was way easier than I thought it was going to be. Okay, I guess we're doing that now.
Take your victories, man. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Little victory. Cool.
Oh, yeah. I'm taking all my victories. No problem.
You're going to take them with a shot of bathtub gin?
Yes, exactly. Oh. Yep. There you go. Thanks for giving the entire audience that picture, Alex. I think we...
You're welcome.
Yeah, we all needed more bathtub gin in our lives.
That's the aesthetic you're going for.
I'm guessing that was not a selling point when you were pitching capers to people. Like, you can make bathtub gin.
There are no... Everybody listening, there are no instructions for making bathtub gin in the game. There's no instructions for brewing alcohol at all. You can find all of that on the internet.
Yep. And you know what? That is literally a homebrew rule you can make.
Oh.
That pun was bad.
Oh, you said
no, it was accurate.
Bad. You said homebrew. Oh.
Yeah, you got to homebrew it. Enjoy that. Now, usually when we have people on the show and they have a Kickstarter for a game, they've come on to talk about one that's currently going on. And actually, Capers has successfully been backed on Kickstarter to great acclaim, actually, and far more than what you were looking for, correct?
Yeah. Ended up with 532 backers, which is a really, really solid number. I went and did some looking at, like, you know, like little indie RPGs of this kind of this scale and scope of the stuff that I do. Getting over 500 backers is, that's a damn solid Kickstarter.
That's half a thousand. That's a lot of people.
Oh, that's a good way of looking at it. That makes it even better.
Half a thousand. I'm a half thousandaire.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it is the 1920s. I'm sure there were a few people out there, like, running booze thinking, I'm a half thousandaire now.
Hey, in the roaring 20s, a half a thousand dollars is a lot of money.
A lot of money. That is good. We are going out on the town and treating everyone to lobster dinner. That's right.
You're buying the town.
That's good money right there. Yeah. That's a really impressive turnout. What did you learn during this Kickstarter that you might not have known during your first game?
Well, the first game was, you know, kind of, I mean, both these games are niche games, right? They're not your typical genres. They're not science fiction or fantasy. And then, the couple of other genres that tend to do fairly well, like horror games tend to do fairly well. Murders and Acquisitions is very niche because it's really, you know, it's a game about beating people up in an office, essentially. It's, you know, climbing the corporate ladder by whatever means necessary. So it's this just,
right,
you know, corporate with, it's fantasy wish fulfillment for anybody who's ever worked in an office.
Sure.
And, Capers benefited this time around. This Kickstarter benefited from a number of things, and it's just one of those things that you kind of have to build on. It's like it's a broader genre so that it has a better fan base, because Supers games do actually fairly well just in as a group. Mm-hmm. Supers games are popular. I had built a little bit of a fan base, so that helped a little bit. And I knew more people in the industry who could, you know, give me a little shout out, so that helped. And the game, the Kickstarter took off pretty fast. It funded in 6 hours, which, the faster a Kickstarter funds, the better everything goes. Absolutely everything. So, I mean, if you can fund your Kickstarter in the first day, that's really solid, because you're still going to have, like, that second and third day are usually pretty busy days for a Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. The better it does in that first day or half day or even 6 hours is going to escalate how well it does for the rest of that first day or the second day or the third day. So then you get off to a really big start and you get more people looking at it and you get more people who, even if they don't back it, they press that, you know, remind me later button. And then they get the email notification at 48 hours to go. And that helps you get that big spike at the end. So this Kickstarter was, the success of this Kickstarter was built very much on everything I had done for the past couple of years. And I saw that, you know, clearly in some of my the analytics for where I saw where pledges were coming from and with the sheer number of pledges you know, how much I saw as far as like people sharing stuff. I saw this time around, I saw more people who sought me out, which didn't happen a lot at all during the initial during the first Kickstarter. This time I had people contacting me. All of a sudden I'd get an email saying, hey, well, I'd love to, you know, write interview you, or ask you a few questions, write about you on my blog. Or I submitted things to RPG news sites that didn't carry anything about Murders and Acquisitions before, but this one did so much better that it kind of pops up on the radar a little bit. So that means I got a few news sites to carry it, and that generated a few more backers, and it was just a big snowball kind of thing. So, you know, to anybody out there who's doing a Kickstarter for whatever it might be, it's a lot of work, but it's, you know, do all those pieces, everything you can think of to get the thing really rocking and rolling early on will just snowball in general and make the whole campaign, you know, turn out better.
And turn out better it did for Craig and Capers, as they funded for about 5 times what their goal was on Kickstarter. Now, if you are interested in getting a copy of Capers, you can still do that. There is a way to put in a late pledge if you go to their Kickstarter page, and there's a way to get to the backer kit. And you can still do that until Craig goes to print, which is going to be later in the year. Make sure to follow him on Twitter at NerdBurgerCraig. And if you want more information about Capers, you can also go to www.nerdburgergames.com/capers. You can also find all the applicable links in the description to this episode. If you want to keep apprised of all the stuff that Alex and I do, or what superpowers Alex has decided to give himself that have little to no use, please go over to DelveCast.com. You can find everything there. While you are there, it would be terrific if you could click on that little Patreon button and check out what we have going for our Patreon. We are going to be doing some restructuring soon, so it's kind of a work in progress. But hey, you know, if you check it out, maybe you can give us some feedback on what you'd like to see, or possible rewards that you'd like to see in some of those tiers. That would be really helpful for us. And as always, you can find us on Twitter. I am at Citanium, Alex is at EXP Limited, and the show is at Delve Podcast. On the next show, we continue talking to Craig about what happens with Capers now that it has successfully funded, and the process that is going to go into that. We also pretty much tried to derail him at every conceivable turn, as Alex is apparently obsessed with the idea of bathtub gin, and I am still obsessed by the idea that Capers is also a very salty berry that goes on fish. When we get on a thing, we stick with it, regardless of whether it's working or not. It's that kind of tenacity that has propelled this show through 4 seasons, and I feel like it is a caper that we are still going on now. See how this analogy wasn't really working, and yet I still rolled with it? Exactly. Anyway, we'll see you on the next episode. Thank you for listening. My life is in your hands.
Great. Gonna sacrifice that to the...
That's always gonna work out well for you.
The mob boss.
That's good. Yeah, you really shouldn't get into the mob. It's a bad idea. It's a bad idea. This is my life advice for you right now before we start.
Oh, okay.
Is to let you know. Okay. I care about you, at least on that cursory level where I can say don't join the mob. it would be very hard for you to keep doing the show.
I am very envious of your friendship.
Yeah.
That close. Yeah.
I'll tell you.
That tight, that unbreakable.
Oh, it really is. It's something. Well, like about twice a year, we have to see each other at family get-togethers. So we have to, you know, maintain some sort of a friendly relationship, or it would be awkward.